Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, Nan Calvert and a representative of the Wisconsin DNR. In part two, best-selling author Rick Reardon. And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the Morning Show. And we're really happy that we can have her along with her colleague from Root Pike Wind, Dave Giordano, and a very special guest who joins us from the Wisconsin DNR, Joshua Brown. And we welcome everybody. Nan, I want you to say a quick word about your connection with Joshua Brown and what prompted you to issue this invitation to him.
My connection is that I've just met Josh via the interwebs. and the reason I wanted to have Josh join us is just because I've been thinking a lot about wetlands lately, driving around, you know, looking at the very late summer, early fall vegetation, and thinking just about how we cannot live without wetlands. And of course, development happens. And so what do we do when wetlands are lost? How is that fixed? And so there is a portion of the DNR that I think a lot of people don't know about. And Josh is here representing that for us today to talk about what he does and why he does it and how it works. We're going to be talking a bit about wetlands mitigation, which I think sometimes is not terribly well understood. And so that's why I wanted Josh to come on today.
Very good. And we're going to welcome Josh in just a second. Dave Giordano, you're joining us. And I wonder if you could just say a quick word about or explain to the to our listeners the connection between an organization like Root Pike Wind, of which you are the director, and this issue of wetlands. How does the concern and issue of wetlands fold into the overall mission of Root Pike Wind?
Well, as Nan mentioned, wetlands are extremely important to our landscape, our water management, and certainly the habitats of you know, our ecosystem residents. The Pike River Plan that was done in 2014 said that about 90% of our wetlands in the Pike River Basin are gone or altered. If an acre of wetland about a foot deep holds 300,000 gallons of water and 90% of our wetlands are gone or altered, it's no wonder we have flooding issues. I have a theory too that our lake levels are related to our lack of wetlands, where that water is no longer being stored on land, but just being conveyed quickly off into Lake Michigan. So wetlands are extremely important, and I never really understood the importance of wetlands until I took this job at Root Pike Wind. But you know, sometimes they've gotten a bad name because they're you know, when you're doing a development and you have wetlands on your development, you know, that has sort of gotten a bad name. Wetlands have gotten a bad name because of that. Well, wetlands also serve a very important infrastructure need, as I mentioned earlier. They hold a lot of flood water. So the two are really tied together. And I think the DNR and other private firms have done a good job at trying to find a win-win with regard to what to do with wetlands and what happens when they're impacted.
Very good. And that segues nicely into this moment in which we introduce Joshua Brown from the Wisconsin DNR, who has a very direct hand in some of what the DNR does with wetland restoration, and in particular with some projects that are happening right here in southeastern Wisconsin. First, Joshua Brown, we welcome you to the Morning Show. It's great to have you join us.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here.
Before we get into this topic, let's just learn a little bit about you, since I believe this is your first visit to the morning show. Tell us a little bit about where you come from originally, and a little bit about how your own life has led you into this this particular field.
Sure. I'm from Central Illinois originally, about 3 hours south of Chicago. And part of growing up there, I never lived on a farm myself, but a lot of my family grew up on a small grain farm in Western Indiana. So I say, you know, my connection to that farm was my introduction to kind of the natural world and the environment. So I grew up, you know, doing the usual things, being outside a lot, fishing, that sort of thing. I'm a pretty big bird watcher and have been for a long time. So that was also one of my first introductions into environmental stuff. And then once I got to college, I discovered this major called environmental science, which I just loved. You know, it was exactly what I wanted to learn about. Wasn't quite sure how I was going to make it a profession or a career, but really enjoyed, you know, all the different environmental topics we got to cover. And then I guess after college, I traveled around for several years working seasonal jobs for mostly the National Park Service, doing a lot of work with invasive species, both here in the Midwest and also in the Western U.S. And then I knew that I was going to need or should have a master's degree to help myself professionally. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, Madison specifically. And I started at the UW in a master's program called Water Resources Management in 2006. And that's where I kind of just became most interested specifically in wetlands and all the things that they provide, as Dave and Nan just mentioned. And then after my master's program, I started working with an environmental consultant doing a variety of things with wetlands, mainly wetland delineation, which is the mapping of wetlands, determining where the boundaries of wetlands are, and you know, a lot of other things, plant surveys, wetland restoration, so planting wetland plants, spraying weeds, that sort of thing. And then since then, I've been at the Wisconsin DNR for 7 years. My first job there, I did wetland permitting for large utility projects across the state. And then most recently here, my most recent position, doing wetland mitigation, which I've done for about the past going on 4 years. So that's the quick and dirty there.
And you were saying that you are a coordinator of a program which is known as ILF, In Lieu Fee. Explain what this program is all about specifically, in that kind of intriguing title, which is probably important for the public to know.
Sure. First, I must say that wetland mitigation is I think most everyone agrees it's a complicated thing. So I will do my best here to explain it briefly and simply as possible. Specifically to the term ILF, in Wisconsin, there are a couple different ways you can mitigate for wetland impacts. And so first, as far as what mitigation means, in a sense, we're trying to put wetlands back after they have been filled or impacted in some form or another. An example I always give is, let's say a hospital is located in an urban area and the only undeveloped space adjacent to it is a wetland. And so if that hospital needs to expand, they must first, you know, prove that they have no other place to go, and then that their impacts, you know, aren't significant or adverse, meaning perhaps the wetland that's there is already degraded to some extent. And then if they can prove those things, then the department, the DNR, can issue them a wetland permit. But depending on the size of that wetland that they need to fill, they may need to complete wetland mitigation. And typically in Wisconsin, wetland mitigation consists of buying mitigation credits. And I'm sorry for this long-winded answer, but this will get us back to In Lieu Fee here eventually. And so they'll need to buy mitigation credits in order to receive their permit. And there are two main types of mitigation credits they can buy. One is a private bank credit, which comes from a mitigation bank, and the other is an in-lieu fee credit. And first, to briefly describe what a mitigation bank is in short, an area of wetland restoration. Can be owned by a municipality, a private citizen, private entity, more or less anyone. And this mitigation bank, it must first be identified, approved, and then restored. And once the site, that mitigation bank has been restored, then they're allowed to sell mitigation credits, which I previously mentioned. And in short, what a credit is an acre of wetland restoration. So it's mitigation's form of currency. And so when, let's say, the hospital had to fill a wetland, they had to buy a certain number of credits based on the size of the wetland they impacted. And then these mitigation banks are allowed to sell these credits to mitigate for those wetland impacts.
So these credits then, in a sense, cover the cost of the mitigation.
Exactly. Yes. A private bank, private banks are allowed to profit off of selling these credits, whereas my program, because it's state run, we are not allowed to profit. But yes, in short, the amount of money that these credits cost is meant to cover the restoration. So I just mentioned these private mitigation banks, and that brings me back to in-lieu fee. And the other option in Wisconsin for wetland mitigation is my in-lieu fee program. And the word in-lieu fee comes from, let's say the hospital buying credits from my program in lieu of buying them from these private banks, which I was just mentioning. No one can make these private banks start up. And so, not all parts of the state have these banks available. So that's, in cases like that, that is when my program comes in and we sell our credits in lieu of these private bank credits being available.
So do you have a direct hand in the actual mitigation, or are you more involved in that part of the process in which, in effect, money exchanges hands and arrangements are made for the cost of mitigation to be covered?
I would say both, yes. We're directly involved in the sense that first we do sell the credits to developers, and then with the funds resulting from those credit sales, we have to find and implement the ILF wetland mitigation projects. And when I say, find and implement, we do contract out most all of the work to environmental consultants. And so we aren't, DNR employees aren't actually out there, restoring the wetlands ourselves, but we are responsible for overseeing the projects, getting all approvals, that sort of thing.
Right. I think it would be good to hear from you, and I hope Nan and Dave will chime in if they like. If you can explain what sort of happens in wetland mitigation. I mean, are we talking about a wetland that exists but is damaged that gets restored, or are we talking about creating a new wetland where one does not at the moment exist, so we can continue to have roughly the same amount of wetland? I mean, is it neither of those, both of those, a little of each, when we're talking about wetland mitigation?
Sure. I think it's been shown that restored wetlands, meaning putting back a wetland where it used to be but currently isn't, provides more of those ecosystem functions. So flood abatement, water quality improvement, and wildlife habitat. These quote restored wetlands provide more of those services than quote a created wetland, meaning putting a wetland where there never was one. And in short, to try and find out where those restored wetland opportunities are, where those areas on the landscape that used to be wetlands that currently aren't, you have to look at soils and drainage. And in Wisconsin, especially southern Wisconsin, a lot of previous wetlands that were around, you know, pre-European settlement were drained, of course, for farming. And so our ideal mitigation sites, we're trying to restore these wetlands where they used to be, are on existing farmland that has either been ditched or tile drained. And so when we're out looking anywhere, that's the first place we go to. And it's, again, because first, they're easier to restore. You know, it's easier to put a wetland back where there used to be one than trying to put one where there never was one. And then second, that restored wetland will most likely provide, you know, maximum function to help and improve the watershed.
Anything Nan and Dave want to add to that description?
Not from my end, no.
Yeah, I would just like to add, you know, it's to be able to find and restore a wetland in our watershed is more and more difficult. And especially since we have development in the area where you're getting, where farmers are getting, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for their non-floodplain farmland, it's just, it's very difficult. And, you know, the way our system is set up is they have every right to sell their land and develop it. And you know, so we're not necessarily against that, but we're, you know, we try to help municipalities and developers look at those situations where wetlands can be restored and how that wetland restoration has a bigger impact on the community, not just on that particular parcel. And so when these wetland mitigation projects are put in place, they're not just about satisfying a credit need, but they also create these places where people want to be, because these ILF sites need to be public as part of the agreement. So there's certainly a flood abatement upside and a habitat upside, but there's also a community brand upside in that you now have these special places where, like I said earlier, and I think some people get tired of me saying it, but we only have about 10% of our wetlands left. And so we're really, really concerned about that 10%. We don't want to slip anymore. And if we can find opportunities to bring more of the wetlands back without, you know, significantly hampering development, which we know is going to continue to occur, you know, again, that for us is the win-win we've been talking about.
For those of you just joining us, this is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and with her is her colleague from Root Pike Wind, Dave Giordano, and our special guest is Joshua Brown, who is the ILF program coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So he has a very direct hand in the DNR's wetland restoration projects around the state, including one right here in southeastern Wisconsin. It's my recollection, I'm not sure who is best to answer this, but it's my recollection that when it comes to the matter of Foxconn and its development here in southeastern Wisconsin, that part of the agreement that was brokered is that for every acre of wetland that is lost to the Foxconn development, 2 acres of wetland must be created. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So some of the projects that we're talking about today, then, do those fold into that equation? Are we talking about wetland restoration that is specifically designed in part to create that 2-for-1 wetland ratio that is part of this agreement?
Yes, we are. Specifically, we mentioned the Meacham Road project. And quickly a little background about Meacham Road and then impacts or credits resulting from Foxconn. Meacham Road is our ILF project, which is located in the Pike watershed in southern Racine County. And, you know, watersheds, the scale of watersheds can vary. So you can have a very, very small watershed, say the Pike or the Root, or a larger watershed like the entire Lake Michigan basin. And mitigation in Wisconsin is divided up into 12 different watersheds. So down by you guys in Racine County, it is called the Southwest Lake Michigan watershed. That includes roughly, the Pike Root in the southern half of the watershed and the Milwaukee River watershed in the north. So it extends from the state line down in southeast Kenosha County all the way up into even southern Fond du Lac and Sheboygan counties. And the intent of this this watershed division is to keep wetland mitigation in the same watershed where the impacts occurred. And that is important for some of those ecosystem services and even, public benefit, which Dave mentioned. You know, we want to keep, our wetland restoration in similar areas to where those wetland impacts occurred. So that's, I think, an important point. And then, so specifically to the Foxconn development project, Foxconn itself is in an interesting location because it straddles two different watersheds. The eastern half of the project is located in, I believe it's the Pike. Dave, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right on.
And it's eastern half. So, water from that eastern half of Foxconn flows east into the Pike River and then Lake Michigan. But the western half of the project flows west and south. First into the Des Plaines River, then I believe it's the Fox in Illinois, and ultimately the Illinois River. And so because of that, we wanted to make sure that we separated out the wetland impacts for that project accordingly. The Lake Michigan impacts, that mitigation stayed in the Pike or in Lake Michigan Basin, and then the impacts to the west and the Des Plaines, stayed, the mitigation stayed in that watershed. And so, today specifically we're talking more about Pike and the Root. So yes, the Foxconn development project did require wetland mitigation in the Pike watershed. I believe it was 19 credits they had to purchase. And just to clarify, I don't want to get into semantics too much, but it's 1 acre of impact requires 2 mitigation credits. And again, a credit's approximately an acre, but just to hopefully clarify a little. And so, from the eastern half, the Foxconn project resulted in 19 credits that needed to be purchased to fulfill their wetland mitigation requirements. And then, so my program, we sold them those credits. And then in conjunction with many other credit sales in the watershed, so from everywhere, again, from southern Kenosha County all the way up to Fond du Lac and Sheboygan, any mitigation credits that were purchased are pooled together, and then we take the funds and look for a mitigation site. And also, as Dave mentioned, it's very important for location. So in general, I'm going to keep the mitigation at, in the same watershed is where the impacts occurred, but also we want to prioritize where in the watershed can we get the most bang for our buck, so to speak. Where are the greatest restoration opportunities? Where can we improve flood control the most? Where can we improve water quality the most? On that sort of thing. So those are the, general criteria we're looking for. We're looking for these projects. And that brought us to the Meacham Road site in southern Racine County, as I said, across the street from Sanders Park, if you are familiar with that that park. And that site was for sale, and it fit the criteria I mentioned earlier. It was drained, it was tiled wetland soils that was currently farmed. And so luckily we were able to secure the property, and currently working on the mitigation project.
Well, yeah, if I could just add something to that as well, is the, you know, about the Foxconn development, a lot of the wetland impacts or the wetlands that needed to be mitigated were, you know, they were delineated and indicated, but they weren't, a lot of those wetlands weren't high quality wetlands. In fact, most of the impact areas were essentially being farmed. So, which farmers have every right to do that. It's just the upside with going from wetland that is being farmed to the highest standard of wetland restoration, that lift, as I think the DNR and other people call it, is huge. So it's not like we lost, you know, 19 acres of high quality wetland in one place, and now we're gonna replace it with 38 acres of amazing wetland. We had wetland that was just being farmed. It was very low quality because it wasn't restored. It wasn't like it was originally before it was farmed. So the upside in these mitigation projects is significant.
In terms of really taking it and making it what it once was or what it was sort of meant to be.
Exactly.
Right. So Joshua Brown, explain how this land was procured. I mean, did the Wisconsin DNR buy this land from a farmer who owned it, or otherwise, I mean, who owned this land? How did it become part of this?
Yeah, a good question. For this project in particular, and many of our projects, you know, we do the same things that anyone who's looking for for land or a house does. We would just check the for sale websites online. This parcel, I believe, had been for sale and was sold. But then the new owner put it up for sale again. And anyway, first we identified it. We saw via the aerial photos that there were drain tile present. So we thought it was a good candidate for a mitigation site. But to your question, it's a good one. You know, it's not always easy to find landowners to own these mitigation sites. And that's been a difficulty for us sometimes. But in some instances, environmental consultants, the companies who have the expertise and experience to implement these mitigation projects, they're also willing to own them. And the In Lieu Fee program, you know, paid this consultant, it's called KCI, they're located in La Crosse, we paid them to own the property, but they're willing to do that so that they can, are also then can be paid for, you'll get the contract to implement the wetland mitigation project also. So that's the short of how we found it. But we also work in the rest of the state, I should add, you know, we work with land trusts, municipalities. We have two different projects with municipalities, private citizens, and we do some projects on DNR-owned property also.
So if we were to drive down Meacham Road right now, adjacent to Sanders Park, would we see any evidence of this work already being done? And if so, what?
I do not think so. I hesitate because I think work is going to start very soon. I think what you would see now is just like an abandoned farm field. I don't think it was farmed this year. But then, you know, the work that is going to start very shortly will be, I think first they're going to mow it, for example, but then they'll also put up I don't know if you're familiar with silt fencing, you know, erosion control. They'll put this black knee-high fencing around the site because it will be exposed soil. So you just want to make sure that no soil runs off. But no, you could not really tell very little right now that it's going to be a wetland.
Right. I wanted to get that clarification for our listeners and for myself, because if one drives down Wood Road, which is kind of on the other side of Sanders Park to the west, there's an empty plot of land, and there's all kinds of stuff being done right now with huge piping and so on. And I don't know what that is about, but I don't want people to make the same kind of assumption that I did, that has something to do with this a wetland restoration project. That is something else going on. And one needs to be on Meacham Road in order to see this plot of land that we're talking about.
Gotcha. And thank you for the clarification. And we're on the east side of Meacham also, but yes.
Right. So once these preliminary things are done that you just mentioned, then what is the work that happens from that point in order to restore this plot of land into a proper wetland? What physically needs to be done?
Yeah, what will happen this fall after that silt fence is installed is first the drain tile, this underground, you know, I think in this case it's plastic, corrugated, perforated pipe will be disabled and cut. And so drain tile is a pretty crazy thing in my opinion, but water will collect in these underground pipes and then flow off the site quicker. And, you know, one advantage of wetlands is, you know, you get rid of that enhanced drainage and water will sit on the site longer. But first the drain tile will be cut. So it'll be pulled out in sections and removed. In other parts, it will be just cut and disabled underground. And that will be the first step in restoring the hydrology. And then next, later this winter, the site will be seeded. So a variety of native wetland species will be seeded across the site, just, you know, being broadcast from behind a tractor, most likely. And then the following spring in 2021, part of the site will be shrub wetland. And so some little shrub seedlings will be planted. So that's the short of it. And then over the next 5 years, then there's lots of maintenance and monitoring that will occur. So a big component of these projects is to keep out invasive species. And so there'll be a lot of invasive species treatment. And the site also has to be monitored to meet some pretty rigorous performance standards. And so there are already some monitoring wells, which are vertical PVC pipes, which is monitoring the groundwater. Those will continue to be monitored. And then the vegetation will also be monitored for several years.
Very good. So Nan Calvert, just give us a brief idea of the kind of choices that one would make in terms of what to plant in a wetland restoration project like this. I mean, and the significance of those kind of choices.
So there are literally probably over 100 different species from which we could pick of flowering plants or forbs, grasses, sedges, and then as Josh mentioned, there are going to be some woody species planted in there as well, which are really important for all different kinds of wildlife. And so one thing that I would like to say to our listening audience is whenever you are establishing or reestablishing a native landscape, you have to keep in mind the following thing. First, they sleep, then they creep, and then they leap. So in the first 3 years, unless you're using plant plugs or you're using small shrubby species, you're not going to notice a whole lot in the first year. You're going to notice more in the second year, but then by the third year, you're going to see a lot of things happening in that reestablished native planting. And then of course, the key to survival, as Josh says, is really good maintenance. Being certain you're paying attention to any of the non-native invasive species that are trying to get themselves reestablished and getting rid of those so that you can support the establishment and growth of the native species. What's really cool about this though is that it is in concert or in harmony with many of the things that Root Pike Watershed Initiative is doing to help bring back the rusty patched bumblebee, which is one of our many, many native pollinators. But of course the rusty patched bumblebee has declined by 87% over the last few years because of habitat destruction. And many of the plants that this particular native pollinator likes happen to occur in a wetland. So this will not only help mitigate floods and restore hydrology to the area, but it will also be helping to support our native pollinators. So this has so many benefits to it that will be reaped for many, many, many years.
Very good. Dave, do you have anything to add to that?
The only thing I would add is that, you know, the difference between corn or soybeans or other cash crops and native plants is really the root structures. And because, you know, corn doesn't go that deep and soybeans, the root structures of these native plants allow for a lot of absorption and groundwater infiltration. And so, again, there's that lift with going to a restored wetland, you know, from farmland that's just being used for cash crops. The root structures alone create this amazing groundwater infiltration system that, you know, by natural standards, is perfect.
Once this is done, this restoration project is done, Joshua Brown, how close will the public be able to get to this wetland to, in a sense, see it up close and to some extent even enjoy its beauty?
Yes, they'll be able to get as close as they want. All of our sites are required in state law to be open to the public. And, you know, it's important to note that can be honestly a kind of an issue when a project is first getting started, when it's first being restored. But they are, and we definitely want lots of public access and so they can be able to enjoy the site. But for the first couple of years, it's important to, you know, tread lightly, so to speak, just because as Nan, you know, said exactly, you know, it takes a couple of years for these sites to become established. But regardless, the site will be open. I think it's situated in a good location right across from Sanders Park. So, you know, that's good from both, I think, a recreation standpoint and a conservation standpoint, just having, you know, two conserved areas right next to each other. Yeah. And, you know, the site will specifically, you know, it's open for just maybe more the less impactful outdoor activities, you know, hiking, cross-country skiing, bird watching, that sort of thing.
Right. And will it be called something? Will it ever have kind of a fancy name the way a typical state park or national park has a name, or will this simply be the Meacham Road Wetland Project?
Greg, that's an excellent question. And I think it should be, it doesn't yet. Right now it's just the Meacham Road Project, but you know, hopefully I can work with maybe Nan and Dave to think of something. There'll definitely be some signage down the road saying, you know, providing most basic of backgrounds and what it is. But yeah, maybe we can come up with a clever name. I think that'd be a good idea.
Right. Maybe the Joshua Brown Center for Beauty.
Or the Dave Giordano Park, perhaps.
Native Flower Corner. Well, at any rate, whatever it's called, it's a beautiful thing to see in more ways than one. And even though at the moment there's not much to see beyond an empty field, what this represents, of course, is very, very significant. And we hope that it will only heighten the general public's awareness about and appreciation for the importance of wetlands and the importance of wetland mitigation. Joshua Brown, if people want more information about this project, is there more information available from the Wisconsin DNR?
There certainly is. We have a great website, I think. And what you could do, you can just Google Wisconsin DNR, WWCT. And Greg, I apologize. The name of our INLUFI program in Wisconsin is the Wisconsin Wetland Conservation Trust. And I apologize for not bringing that up before. So you can either Google that, or you can also go to the DNR website, which is dnr.wi.gov, and search WWCT.
Very good. Joshua Brown with the Wisconsin DNR, we appreciate you joining us today on the morning show and sharing all of this really interesting information about the important work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. And Dave Giordano, director of Root Pike Wind, I'm glad that you could be part of this as well. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
Nan Calvert, I know you want to finish out with a couple of quick announcements.
Yes, happily, I do have a couple of quick announcements. You know, Halloween is almost here and people have been wondering what they're going to do this year. So I have a couple of suggestions for you. Firstly, Hawthorne Hollow is having its haunted trails on Friday, October 30th at 5:30 and then again at 7 p.m. So these will be sort of controlled crowds. You must wear a mask. Registration is required. $15 for adults, $10 for children. Should be a wonderful time to get out there and have some fun for Halloween and also celebrate and support Hawthorne Hollow. Pringle Nature Center is having a candlelight Halloween hike on October 30th. There will be three sessions for which you can sign up, 6:30, 7 p.m., and 7:30. This is a self-guided, family-friendly hike. You must register. It's $5 per person. Wear a mask, and you can register online. You are not allowed, however, just to walk in and participate in the Pringle Halloween hike. You must register. And last, but certainly not least, the Eco Justice Center is having a second virtual trivia night on October 29th from 7 p.m. till 8:30. It's $10 to register, and registration is required. You can do so online. Just go to the Eco Justice Center's website. You can form teams of 2 to 6 people. And I have to tell you, I did the first trivia night, and it was just a blast. I encourage everybody to sign up for it. It's very fun. There aren't any hard sports questions at all for those of us who know nothing about sports. So, you know, go ahead and participate. It's lots and lots of fun. That's it.
Great idea. And Calvert, thank you for that information, and thank you for arranging for this really illuminating morning show conversation.
Oh, thoroughly my pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
And it is a real delight to reconnect with best-selling author Rick Riordan, the best-selling author of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and the fifth and final installment of the series The Trials of Apollo, called The Tower of Nero, has just been released. And so we're going to talk with Rick Riordan about this this series and about his career as a writer for just a couple of minutes. Rick Riordan, we welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Remind our listeners about where we have been with this particular series, The Trials of Apollo.
Well, The Trials of Apollo is an extension of Percy Jackson's world, meaning that we're dealing with Greek gods and monsters who are running around modern America. This twist, I suppose, with The Trials of Apollo is this time our hero is the god Apollo. He's been punished by his dad Zeus, sent down to Earth as a powerless 16-year-old mortal kid, and he has to do these quests to prove his worth to become a god again. And this, The Tower of Nero, is the final book in which we figure out if he's going to make it back to Mount Olympus or not.
Right. And so we have this wonderful mixture of someone who is used to being a towering mythological god, instead an ordinary teenager in a world he does not understand. Did anything in particular prompt you to create this sort of overall concept? It's so wonderful.
Well, thanks. I've surely had a good time with it. Well, it really, as with all things, I went back to the mythology, and I was surprised to find that this actually happened to Apollo two times in the original stories. Zeus did punish him and basically grounded him as a mortal. And I think that's something that a lot of kids can relate to, the idea of being unfairly punished by your parents. You're not quite sure why you have to be grounded, but you are. And then you have to figure out how to get back into your parents' good graces. And I think there's also something very appealing about it. A character who's used to being powerful and popular and good at everything, and then suddenly he finds out that he's just an utter failure. And certainly I've had mornings when I feel like that, and I think most of us could relate to that too.
Absolutely. Remind our listeners about the wonderful story about what really prompted you to leave your career as a teacher in order to become a novelist. It's a very personal reason that really drew you into this world in the first place.
It is. It wasn't a career path that I planned. I was a middle school teacher for 15 years. I loved doing that. I would always tell stories in the classroom, but I never really thought about being a novelist for young readers until my own son was struggling in elementary school. He had been diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia, And about the only thing he liked was Greek mythology in that particular year. I had told Greek mythology in my own class many times, so I started telling him stories at home just to keep his spirits up. And that evolved eventually into the story of Percy Jackson, who is a young demigod who discovers that he has ADHD and dyslexia also, and that these are actually indicators that you could be descended from one of the Greek gods. And that just sort of developed a life of its own. And the next thing I knew, this story for my son became a novel.
Hmm. What was it like to take these stories that you had told to your son in this fashion and actually set them down on paper? Was that a difficult transition, or did you really find it a very natural progression?
Well, strangely enough, I cut my teeth on adult private eye novels. I had written quite a few of those that had been published as original paperbacks over the years. So I had some experience as a writer, and I had the experience telling stories to middle schoolers. I had just, for whatever reason, never put the two things together. So when the time came to write the story, it did click fairly easily. It's never easy to write a book, but it worked out well, and I felt like I had finally sort of found that synchronicity that maybe I was meant to find.
Mm. I had forgotten from our first conversation that your son had an interest in Greek mythology, and that is one of the reasons why your stories sort of took off in that direction. Do you foresee yourself returning to the arena of ancient Greece in any of your future works? I mean, do you find it to be an arena that is, in a sense, fruitful, even beyond these particular books called The Trials of Apollo?
Well, definitely. It's fertile ground, and we have been mining Greek mythology for millennia. And I could see myself going back maybe to do a standalone novel about one of the characters I've created or another character. We are now looking at really 15 books that are set in Percy Jackson's world. I've done 3 5-book series with different spins and with different characters. So I think I've covered the broad strokes of Greek and Roman mythology for sure. And I think we're leaving it in a good
place.
Sorry about that.
A little editorial comment in the background.
Oh, no, but I think we've left it in a good place, but I think that standalone novels are possible in the future.
Very good. I want to finish out this interview on a personal note of my own by saying that I have a nephew named Kai who has just graduated from high school and begun college, and Kai happens to be dyslexic, and it was the Percy Jackson books that helped him fall in love with reading. And it's made a huge difference in his life. And I know it's made a huge difference in the lives of all kinds of young people who perhaps struggled with reading, maybe even hated reading, until they met the memorable character of Percy Jackson. So I want to thank you for that, and I want to thank you for all of the books that you've given to the world, including The Tower of Nero, the 5th and final book in the series called The Trials of Apollo. Rick Reardon, thank you so much for all of the writing that you have done, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the author of a book called Black Fatigue, which explores some of the sometimes less visible consequences and costs of racism. On Thursday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. On Friday, a British author by the name of Luce Bennett, and the author of a memoir about something with which she has struggled for a number of years, middle age incontinence, one of the last taboos, something really difficult to talk about, but she writes about it in amazing fashion in her fascinating book. We'll talk on Friday. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. And we remind you, The Morning Show is available as a podcast 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg.